Strange Days Indeed continues with Errol Bruce Knapp on UFO News Radio CFRB 1010.
In the studio with me tonight is Tom Theofanis. He's the director, the chair of the Mutual UFO Network of Ontario. Our guest this hour is considered to be the world's leading expert on physical traces found at alleged UFO landing sites. In the past 30 years, he has personally investigated over 500 UFO reports. In 1975, he compiled the Physical Trace Catalog, which was published by the Center for UFO Studies, QFOS. Over 2,200 events cataloged in there from over 5,000 cases representing alleged UFO landings in 79 countries. This is a man who knows between onions and UFOs. Ted is the director of the Center for Physical Trace Research. He's a research associate at the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, a staff member of the Mutual UFO Network, physical trace advisor, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP. He was a field engineer at the Minuteman Missile Project in the United States. He was a participant in the Vanguard Satellite Tracking Program, an engineering inspector, and is the author of numerous scientific papers and physical traces associated with UFO sightings. Joining us on the line from his home near Branson, Missouri, is Ted Phillips. Ted, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thank you.
It's good to have you back. You know, this cave that you came across the story about is somewhere in Eastern Europe, former Soviet bloc country. Each time you've been on here, there's been a flow of phone calls and email about what's been going on. What's Ted been up to? What's happening with the cave?
Well, quite a lot, actually. I managed to scrounge enough funding to get back there again, and I spent April, May, and June traveling about 10,000 kilometers in a Skoda. I don't know if you've seen or ever driven a Skoda.
A Skoda is a car, for those of you who aren't familiar.
Yes. Well, at any rate, I rented it at the airport in Prague. What I was doing, I was backtracking historically the individual who saw this artifact in the cave during World War II. As I said, I traveled about 10,000 kilometers by automobile to tracking down his old haunts, where he was born, where he lived, the property he owned, and so on. And all this is spread out over three countries, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and the Ukraine. As you go east from the Czech Republic, things change dramatically. It's a pretty amazing country. It's really another planet to go into the eastern area of Slovakia and into the Ukraine. Very rugged country, at least where I was going, in the Carpathian Mountains. And not a fun place to try to locate a tiny cave entrance. As you know from earlier shows, I started working on this in 1970.
What's a UFO guy doing this for?
Well, I'll tell you what. The UFO landing cases have just about dropped to zilch. And this is a cycle that's been underway now since the mid-80s. Each year I see fewer and fewer, and this 2001, there has not been one high-quality landing with traces event that I'm aware of. In 1970, a friend of mine called me from 800 or 900 miles away, and he said, "I've got a fellow here that you need to talk to." So the wife and I took a little vacation and went out there and talked with this gentleman, who by birth is a bohemian. This man graduated from four universities, had degrees in engineering, mining engineering, linguistics. Very intelligent, very well-educated man. He told me his story. He fortunately maintained a very detailed diary throughout the war, and I was able, of course, to see the diary and get copies. After quite a battle with the German forces in some trenches, he and two other men were the only ones left out of 184. They were left for dead. They were rescued by a sheep herder who took them and hid them in a cave with a very small entrance. He, in looking for food, they hadn't eaten for 4 days. He goes back in the cave and finds this artifact, this large structure. So after I talked to him, after I looked at the diary, and so I was so impressed with this guy and his wife, I called Alan Hynek and suggested he go talk with him. He did. And we both agreed that this definitely should be pursued. And Jackie Gleason was going to fund the trip over there in 1970, but the Russians were in the process of tearing things up over there, and we couldn't go. So I had to wait till 1999 until I had funding to get over there.
The artifact back down there was what, Ted, that you heard of?
It's a couple of miles into the cave. It's about 2,500 feet below the mountaintop. This trip, this year, I was fortunate enough in the last, well, after having been there over 2 months, to find this thing. Find the cave, and I had been within 12 feet of the entrance many times. It's very difficult to see the way it's situated, and the terrain is very rough, and it's difficult to see any distance at all.
I want to tell our listeners that it's radio with pictures tonight. If you go to www.virtuallystrange.net and follow the UFO links through to the program, and in the tonight's listing there, next to Ted's name in the right-hand box, there's a European cave, and if you click that link, it'll take you through to a series of photographs. You can look at the countryside and see what Ted is talking about.
It's a great place to lose weight and trim yourself up and get in good shape.
It's some fairly hefty mountains there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very rugged, very steep, and inhospitable. I was thrilled to find that this particular mountain, where the cave's located, is absolutely crawling with snakes. So I sent you the image this morning of the 1700s painting of the guy fighting the Carpathian vipers.
That's what that was. The guy who looked almost dwarfed by this viper.
Yeah, fortunately, I didn't hit any of those size, but I was taken by the director of a large museum castle down into the dungeons of the castle and allowed not only to see but photograph World War II photos that have never been seen. When I saw the vipers, knowing the situation on that mountain, I had to make a copy of it. It's almost that bad, not quite, but almost. Mm-hmm. I managed to step on several, and they're quite poisonous.
I assume that you didn't get bitten because you ain't near any help up in these mountains.
Well, that's true. It's 7-hour minimum hike from your nearest transportation to the cave. The old locals told me that you have about 4 hours if one of these things hits you. You know, you get to a point where you really don't worry that much about it because you're going to die before you could walk out. That was the big problem. There also are wild boars, very large mountain lions and bears in this area. When you're in there stumbling around by yourself, you stay pretty alert,
I would say.
Although I don't know why I couldn't outrun the things.
Okay, so you found the cave entrance.
Yes. Went as far as I could. The geologist and his two colleagues were hidden in the entrance room of the cave, which is not much of a problem to get to. There are a lot of very big bomb craters outside the cave, and they've done quite a lot of structural damage to the cave, to parts of it. And the room now that they stayed in, the part of the floor has collapsed down into about a 40-foot pit, which you see some of the collapse there in two of those photos. And it is considerable. Everything in the room was as he had described it to me personally and also in the diary. One of the three men died in a small alcove in that room from his wounds, and they had placed stones in that alcove. They would heat them and put them around him, try to keep him warm. The alcove is there. The stones are still in the alcove. They carved his initials as ornately as they could at the base of this alcove with an arrow pointing into it. And we also found some very, very old bandage.
You found the initials, huh?
Yeah, we found all three men's initials. So there's no doubt it's the right cave. The problem is that in the collapse area, you have to actually hang upside down on a rope and let people lower you down about 40 feet. You can see where the cave enlarges and goes on. But the problem is, above you, for a distance of 40 feet, is a lot of very large rocks that are ready to come down.
Mm-hmm.
So, sensibly, you couldn't go any further because you have to do a little bit of digging down there to widen it where you can continue on. There's just sort of a rubble plug there. And so my plans now are to go back and find over there a mining expert, someone that knows shoring, and try to make this funnel safe enough to continue on.
There are those people in the field who feel that what's going on now in modern times with UFOs dates back many tens of thousands of years. And somehow, all of the things that we hear in myths and legends, and all of the things that we have in our various religious books, are nothing but a history of ancients who came from elsewhere. Need to tell you that as this particular hour of the program proceeds a while. Out there on the phone down in his home near Branson, Missouri, is Ted Phillips. Can we touch on briefly what it is that you believe is back there in the bowels of the earth, Ted?
That's the fascinating part of this whole thing. If I might, I would quote from the 1944 diary at a point where the geologist finds this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quoting here, he said, "After 1.5 hours, I came into a long level passage, and at its end, upon a barrel-sized hole. Crawling through and still kneeling, I froze in amazement. There stands something like a large black silo framed in white limestone formation. I became perplexed, then awestruck, when I saw it is a glass-smooth flank of a seemingly man-made structure which reaches into the rocks on all sides. Cylindrically curved, it indicates a huge body with a diameter of about 25 meters. The wall is uniformly blue-blackish. Its material seems to combine properties of steel. The pick made no marks and bounced off vigorously. The thought of a tower-sized artifact embedded in rock in the middle of an obscure mountain in a wild region where not even legend knows about ruins, mining, industry, overgrown with age-old cave deposits, is bewildering." Now, that's, in his own words, written at the time he was looking at this thing. This thing is a fat crescent shape. The best way I can describe it is a crescent-shaped shaft that runs not quite vertically. It's about 16 degrees off of vertical up to some point above him. He was not able to see the top end of it because he didn't have enough light. He had torches. In this exposed section that he just described there, the outer part of the outer wall was a crack. And he was able to take his clothes off, wiggle through the crack, in other words, through the actual outer wall of this thing, which is 7 feet thick. And as he went through the wall, he rolled down at about a 60-degree incline until he hit the back wall of this thing, whereupon he's standing inside of this 85-foot or so wide crescent on a deposit of limestone. And this thing is absolutely smooth, no seams, no rivets. He even fired a military rifle at one part of this thing, and it simply gave off green sparks and didn't even scratch this thing. He was trying to get some sort of piece to bring back out. He just had no way to obtain a sample of the object itself because he couldn't find any way to break it at any point. Where he's standing on this limestone deposit at what to he is the base of this thing, he takes his pickaxe and in one corner he chops his way over a period of 3 days through 60 inches of limestone deposit. Now, under most conditions, that deposit would have taken about 6,000 years to accumulate. Under this 6,000 or so year old deposit, he finds the skeleton of a large animal, and he brings three of the teeth out with him, which are later identified at a university museum as an extinct species of cave bear, which became extinct over 11,000 years ago. This being under a 6,000-year deposit. And beneath the skeleton, continuing on downward, he finds a wavy configuration like a grill work that extends on down and then turns to the right. And he placed his cheek on that grill. He could feel heat coming up through it. And he could hear sounds, he said, like some sort of engine or turbine or something in the distance. Now, I've got to tell you, one of the most fascinating things, this area is so complex, and you're looking for something so small, I finally determined that the best way to approach this was to start gridding from the peak of the mountain. So each day, if I didn't stay up there in a tent, each day when I would go back in, I would take this same path up and over the peak of the mountain. I had a Slovakian, now friend, with me, who I trust, and we were using walkie-talkies, and we noticed as whenever either one of us would go through this one area, it was as though the things just were zapped of all power, and it would just go dead, and GPS units would do the same thing. And we had three GPS units and three compasses, a digital compass, and electromagnetic field meter. And we started noticing that this was about a room-sized area on the mountain where this would take place. So I eventually took the EM meter up there and placed it on the ground along with two compasses and backed up with a video camera just to shoot these things. And every 2 seconds, the compasses would swing with a pulse and the EM meter would scream every 2 seconds.
Does that tie into the grill the rock has grown around in this cave and the pulsing that the geologist heard during the Second World War there?
At the time that I videotaped this, I was videotaping it just for the oddity, but a week later when I actually found the cave entrance, I then, of course, did a survey inside the cave to be able to draw it, and the passage that should go, according to the map that the geologist gave me of the cave, that should go to the artifact, in fact, the cave is running right back toward this area. And another interesting thing was there's a small monument out in front of the cave area where 1 month before the geologist was hidden in the cave in 1944, A Russian aircraft crashed there, and my Slovakian friend could translate just enough of it to see that the monument said that the aircraft crashed due to unusual circumstances involving instruments.
Huh.
And I can tell you this, if a plane flew over this area, this room-sized area, it would be affected.
Mm. Did the aircraft crash close by?
It crashed several hundred feet in front of the where the cave entrance is at.
Would it cause the collapse
subsequent
to 1944?
No, the crash was far enough away away from the direction that the cave runs.
Okay.
Looking at all those big bomb craters all around the entrance, I can understand why there's a lot of collapse.
Why would they bomb a side of a mountain? Was there some sort of military target there, Ted?
Well, military in a sense, people. After the geologist came out of the cave, which was at the end of October, he went on south and east to rejoin the forces that he was fighting with. But other forces were coming in, some of the underground army and Russians, into the area where the cave is located. And so the Germans were bombing, and then the Russians were bombing. And this was the latter part of 44 into the early part of 45. So the collapse and so on wasn't there when the geologist was.
Mm. Right.
It's fascinating stuff. It really is.
Mm.
It really is.
I want to ask you, how deep did you manage to go into this cave?
By measurement, I managed to get in there about 700 feet, which is not very far, but unfortunately, that's where this plug is at. And it gets much larger and it goes on, but it's getting past that funnel, which can be done. I were in a cave and I was bound and determined in the United States where I could get some help, it wouldn't be any problem. Over there, it is a problem.
Are the locals, aware of these caves?
The locals are quite afraid of caves. There are many, many very old legends about caves. Even the sheep man who hid the geologist and his men in there told him that the cave was haunted. And every time that he would come into the cave, he would go through the holy rites, blessing the cave and himself. But I found a letter to the geologist from a friend of his who talked to the sheep man in 1970 when we were trying to get over there. The sheep man had been taken and had seen the artifact with his father and his father's father many years earlier.
And he described it in the same way that the geologist's diary?
He would not discuss it nor describe it.
Oh, really?
But he did admit that there was something in there that he saw as a young man with his father and his grandfather.
Hmm.
And that he never wanted to go back in there again. With the attitude of the locals over there, I can understand. It would have been quite something for him to conjure up enough courage to go back in there, even with his father and grandfather. They're just quite afraid of caves.
Did the geologist ever go back after the war?
Yes. On his way home after the war ended, he had to go through that area on his way back to the Czech Republic. He did stop about 300 feet from the entrance, and he looked at it through field glasses. And he was obviously, he'd been at war for 5 years, and he was not in a caving mode. So he planned to go back home, rest up, and return. Well, when he got home, then the Russians wanted him to work with them. He refused, and he became a fugitive. And he and his wife had to go to Paris until 1951, when they were accepted into the U.S. and they came over. So he was not able to go back. When I talked to him in 1970, he was 72 years old and just wasn't physically able to go back, although he wanted to very, very much.
Mm.
That saddens me that he didn't get to go back and see it, but he trusted me to do it the right way, and so he gave me, every bit of information that he had. And everything that he told me is up to the point of the artifact itself is true. I can't confirm that yet, but I do know this is the case.
Well, there's certainly some kind of anomaly there, isn't there?
I've used instruments in a lot of places around the planet, and I've never seen instruments do what these were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this area is so remote, there cannot be any kind of electrical or magnetic fields. This was actually reacting on the EM meter in the electromagnetic field. I mean, the incredible thing was to see those two compasses swing precisely together. as though something was coming on, turning off, coming on, every 2 seconds precisely. Could it be that this thing is still doing something? It seems absolutely impossible, but...
Well, if that 25-meter crescent-shaped hollow obelisk with the bones of an extinct species of cave bear, beneath which was a grill of some kind, you said, that the rock had grown around...
And been deposited on.
There was heat coming through the grill and a throbbing sound?
Yes, a throbbing sound, he said, like very distant machinery of some sort. And again, you know, I have to stress, this guy was an engineer and a mining engineer.
Mm-hmm.
He owned a vast, vast piece of property up in Bohemia and prior to the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And he had on that property uranium mines. And as a matter of fact, over the years, back in the 30s, he came to the U.S. and did some mining studies, and he went to Argentina, did some mining studies. So this is a man that's quite familiar with the underground. And along with being a geologist, for crying out loud, you know, he could tell a natural formation. When you're standing in the middle of something that's 30 feet wide and 85 feet or so in diameter with 7-foot walls and a curvature like that, a perfect curvature, you're not talking about anything natural. It just doesn't happen in nature. The more I've gotten into this, and as you called me the other day, becoming a bone collector, I think that's true.
A relic hunter is the way I described it.
Relic hunter.
You're not the only guy who's out there hunting relics right now, are you?
No. There may be, if what I hear is true, and it comes from a very good source, a huge discovery that's being investigated right now and has been under investigation for over 3 months now. Also, since I've been back from over there, I've become aware of two additional artifacts in two other parts of the world. One of them, thank goodness, is in a warm climate, so that's what I'm shooting for first. I really believe that there are a number of these things in existence on this planet. What they represent, I have no idea. The geologist and I, and Hynek at the time, discussed this. What could this thing have been used for?
So where do you go from here, Ted? This is now your second trip over there?
Mm-hmm.
You managed to get some funding to do that, and now you have a sort of major obstacle to over. Well, two major obstacles: the physical obstacle in the cave where the where stuff has collapsed, and you've got that hanging upside down drop that several people, I would say, have to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a fairly skilled crew to go in there. That, as you said earlier, it's relatively easy to put together in North America, but when you get over there into Slovakia, that's going to be a little tougher for you, isn't it?
Yes, would be very difficult, because as I say, most of those folks won't even consider going in a cave,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not hanging upside down in one. As a matter of fact, there are a couple of people, my good friends over there, who really believe I'm nuts now. By the way, they wouldn't go in the cave. They stayed in the entrance. You know, I was just frightened of it. What I'm hoping to do is be able to put together a 3 or 4 person. You've got to keep the numbers low. A very major power on this planet is also looking for this thing.
Mm.
And they have contacted me some time ago. And they began a project in 1981 to find this thing. And their problem is they don't have the diary sketches and direct information that I had.
Tom is sitting across the desk from me going, "Major power? Who's he talking about?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, he's somewhat reluctant to say who it is.
It's not the U.S.
Okay.
I could deal with that, I think, but these folks might be more difficult to deal with.
But okay.
My whole thing is to prove to myself that this thing is there, get back out, and then sneak in a couple of scientists at a time, let them do their thing, and establish what this thing is made of, if possible, and so on. Do everything that we can do, because when the country it's located in becomes aware of it, you'll not get in that cave again. So that's the problem. Otherwise, I'd be happy to tell you and your listeners everything I know about this. I wish I could.
Yeah, appreciate it, Ted.
I wish I could.
You said you had some funding to go back. Do you have funding to go back yet again and continue on with some people who have some expertise in surmounting the physical difficulties that you've encountered there?
At this point, I do not. Mm. The last funder was a private individual, and I think it just about broke him to do this, but he believes in this thing. Put a lot of money that he really couldn't spare into going over there. It takes a while. When you go live in a country for 3 months, it becomes expensive. But we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. I did 3 months over there for, I think, about $12,000, including the flight and the rental car and everything else. So it's not tremendously expensive to have to do, but again, $12,000-$20,000 is a lot of money to get your hands on.
So what you need is a couple of spelunkers who are geologists and miners and also seriously interested in some relic hunting, huh?
Yes, and above all else, people that you can absolutely trust, because if certain things are found out, we'll not have access to it.
Right.
And I'll tell you, it was tough enough for me to come out of that cave, being within a mile or two of this thing and not being able to get to it. So that was a very difficult thing to do. And
well,
especially when you're sitting there looking, you know, videotaping all of these things that
mm-hmm.
fit.
Yeah. Ted, we have about a minute and a half left, and I don't want to rush you out of here. What can we do to help you?
Obviously, anyone that has any information on what appear to be very old and odd artifacts, I would greatly appreciate hearing, because, you know, I'm planning on getting some funding. I have a couple of possibilities, but they're kind of long shots. Beyond that, just need to find somebody with some coins that has enough interest in this stuff that would like to try to break through into some new ground. As much as I love investigating UFO landing sites, you're still going in after the fact.
Right.
These things are there, and they're not going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. People can get in touch with you either by writing SDI at virtuallystrange.net or going to www.virtuallystrange.net, going to the program page, looking at program 169, you'll see Ted's picture there. You can go to his website. There are various ways of connecting with Ted Phillips, should you care to do so. Ted, do keep in touch. Let us know how the project is going. We will check in with you periodically, and we'll see what we can do in the background here.
Great, my friend. I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and I always enjoy this show.
Thanks, Ted Phillips.
All right. Bye-bye.
We'll stay in touch. Happy New Year, Ted.
Same to you.
And a prosperous and discoverful one, too.
I hope so.
Ted Phillips in studio, Tom Theofanis. We will come back with Sandy Nichols.
Strange Days Indeed will continue with Errol Bruce Knapp on UFO News Radio, CFRB 1010.